the 2006 International AIDS Conference, Time to Deliver, brought to you by KaiserNetwork.org.
International AIDS Society and co-chair of this International AIDS Conference. And it's with great pleasure that I am here to welcome and open this meeting. We really thought that this was an incredibly important opportunity to bring together leaders of all different types, leaders in the political realm, the community realm, leaders representing people living with HIV/AIDS, the religious and faith community, and other members of civil society, governments, and leaderships at the highest level in many ways. And that to focus the attention on the plight and the issues related to women and girls, we thought was extremely important as we continue to face the challenges that are represented as we look at what will it take to make a difference for young women and girls around the world in this epidemic who are increasingly affected. So it's my pleasure to begin by introducing José Vernet, who was elected as a Member of Parliament in 2006 of January from the region of Saint-Louis-Laurent. On February 6, 2006, she was appointed as the Minister of International Cooperation and Minister for La Francophonie and Official Languages in Prime Minister Harper's cabinet. Ms. Vernet is deeply involved in her community and has spent a significant amount of time fundraising for the Children's Make-A-Wish Foundation and has a deep commitment to these issues. She is married and has three children, and we're very pleased to have her with us today to give us some welcoming comments on behalf of the Government of Canada.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure for me to be here today. I am pleased that Canada is hosting this important conference. Et c'est un réel honneur pour moi d'ouvrir cette rencontre axée tout spécialement sur la situation des femmes. Je me réjouis de vous y accueillir en si grand nombre car je suis très préoccupée par le sort des filles et des femmes qui souffrent du VIH-SIDA ainsi que de celles qui mènent la lutte contre le VIH-SIDA. Canada has gained an international reputation for advancing gender equality issues. Gender inequalities fuel the epidemic. The rates among women are rising more quickly than among men. Canada strongly supports the promotion and protection of gender equality and of human rights, including sexual and reproductive rights. These elements are key to any effective initiative to fight HIV/AIDS. As you know, women are at higher risk than men of getting HIV infected and increasing infection rates among them demonstrates how vulnerable they are. This further highlights the inequalities between women and men and between girls and boys. Generally speaking, women and girls do not benefit from the same control over their lifestyle choices, especially over decisions regarding their sex life and the use of preventive measures. Because of their precarious situation, women and girls do not have the liberty to insist for safe sexual practices, nor can they refuse sexual relations. Education is key. Les femmes et les filles sont couramment privées de moyens de s'informer et de s'éduquer. L'accès à l'information est particulièrement ardu lorsqu'il s'agit de s'informer sur les stratégies et les moyens de prévention des maladies transmises sexuellement. Je m'intéresse particulièrement au sort des femmes et des filles qui sont contraintes d'abandonner l'école ou de renoncer à leurs activités professionnelles rémunérées pour s'occuper des membres de la famille qui sont malades. All individuals have the right to complete and accurate information on how to prevent HIV infection. This is of particular importance to women as they face double discrimination when they are HIV positive. more than just an objective. Canada is determined to put a stop on the HIV/AIDS pandemic and is committed to promoting gender equality. Those are two important objectives of our development assistance program. But achieving gender equality and fighting HIV/AIDS are far more than objectives. They are fundamental prerequisites and very closely linked. If we fail to address the gender equality issue and to stop the spreading of HIV/AIDS, there is very little hope for improvement in other development areas. Tous, autant que nous sommes, nous devons mettre en œuvre des stratégies de lutte qui protègent les droits des femmes et des filles. Des stratégies qui favorisent la participation des femmes sur un pied d'égalité avec les hommes à toutes les étapes du processus. J'ai bon espoir que les discussions qui s'amorcent seront fructueuses. Ensemble, nous pouvons faire en sorte que les femmes et les filles aient les moyens d'exercer leur droit de se protéger. In closing, I would like to invite you on behalf of Canada's Minister of Health, the Honorable Tony Clement, and the International AIDS Society to a reception immediately following the session. Minister Clement would like to take this opportunity to welcome you to Canada and to the conference, as well as discuss with you the importance of health systems in the response of HIV/AIDS. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and I would be remiss in not mentioning how grateful we are to the government and the people of Canada for hosting this conference this year. We really appreciate the hospitality and all that the support, financial and otherwise, that went into helping to support the conference, this session, and so many other things. So we really do thank you for all the support you've given us. I'd now like to turn it over to Dr. Peter Piot, who is going to give us a keynote message for this session. And as most people probably know, Professor Piot is the executive director of UNAIDS. He was appointed the executive director of the Joint United Nations Program on HIV/AIDS and Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations in 1994. Dr. Piot joined UNAIDS from a position as Associate Director of the Global Program on AIDS of the World Health Organization. He's an old friend of IAS, as he served as the President of the International AIDS Society from 1991 and 1994, and is a long-term friend and colleague. So I, without further ado, turn it over to Peter Piot.
Thank you, Helene, and good morning or good afternoon, everybody, Your Royal Highness, Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, dear friends. This pre-conference is really a wonderful initiative. And I hope that the conference in Toronto will be billed as the Women's Conference when it comes to AIDS, reflecting what is actually happening with the epidemic all over the world. So it's really a fitting way to start off the week's deliberations with this special session. And I hope it will produce some clear action-oriented solutions that will make a real difference for women and girls, because we've got to go beyond the rhetoric saying and fill another volume of Congress proceedings and saying that women are discriminated and that women are also unequal and fatally unequal in the face of AIDS. This conference comes at a time of great opportunity and hope in the global response to AIDS. And I think that is how we should look at the conference. Why am I saying that? In the first place, because we finally, 25 years in this epidemic, so not too late, not too soon, we finally are starting to see results. In May, UNAIDS gave out its traditional report on the global epidemic, and for the first time since I'm in this job, we could point to results on the ground, for people on the ground. By that I mean less people becoming infected, particularly in some of the Eastern African countries, some of the Caribbean countries, some countries or big states in Asia, and secondly, far more people than ever before in developing countries are benefiting from antiretroviral therapy, about 1.5 million at the moment, coming from basically only a few hundreds of thousands at the time of the conference in Bangkok 2 years ago, when you take that as a reference. It doesn't mean that we can cry victory. I would never use the term success story even for any of these. There are no success stories in AIDS yet, but there are results. And there is, to use that term, a return on the investment thanks to a formidable political commitment and momentum which has also generated significant funding last year, about $8.3 billion. So this is the good news. The bad news, of course, is also there. By any definition, AIDS continues to be an emergency, a crisis, with so many dying every day, so many becoming infected. And the level of denial that is still there and the lack of leadership that we still find is just beyond any human comprehension or any rational comprehension, maybe human comprehension. So I would say that there's been more progress in the past 4 or 5 years than in the previous 20 years in the fight against AIDS. But the question is now, does it also, all this, does this for women? Does this work for women? What is the relationship between women and AIDS in terms of these positive results? And I won't bore you with statistics. You'll be overwhelmed by them over the next several days. But just two things. One is that what started and was described 25 years ago as in a report of 5 gay men with a mysterious pneumonia has become now the world's leading cause of death among both men and women, leading cause of death under the age of 60. I mean, that's unprecedented, something that didn't even exist 25 years ago. Well, it existed, but it was not known, has become the leading cause of death for men and women. And secondly, what we are seeing is an increasing feminization of the epidemic everywhere. I could say that Africa is in the lead on this macabre gender equality exercise, but where 60% of all people living with HIV are women. But in every single region in the world, the proportion of women among those living with HIV is on the increase everywhere, and particularly among young women. And it's fair to say that the response to AIDS is still very far from women's needs. And I could again give you many statistics underscoring the deadly and massive gap in terms of the AIDS response meeting women's needs. The most striking for me, actually, is the one where you look at HIV infection rates among young women, teenage women, women under 25. Here, in some countries, in some communities, as many as 8 to 10 times more women and girls of that age group are infected than boys and young men of that age group. That doesn't happen by coincidence. That is not a result of biology, a little bit, but that is the result of, reflects the power relations and particularly the sexual power relations in society. And as long as we don't address these power relations, and as long as we don't address the drivers of this epidemic, I think we have no chance of bringing this epidemic under control. And that's, for many people, a very unpleasant message and an unpleasant reality. But we have to bring it over and over again. So why is the AIDS response still failing women? And I could give you probably a list of 50 reasons, and I'll give you just a few. Because I believe it's essential to understand this clearly if we are to have effective strategies for improving the response to women. One, I would say, the AIDS response in most countries is still not taking full account of the extent to which gender inequality and the low status of women are driving the epidemic. That is not recognized, or it is in a preamble or in some footnote, but particularly when it comes to to the budget, it's not in there. So in other words, it's not taken seriously. So that has to change, and it has to be funded fully to the same extent as distributing condoms and providing antiretrovirals. And similarly, the AIDS response has not taken account of the needs of especially vulnerable groups, such as sex workers, migrants, and so on, which all also are affecting women disproportionately. Secondly, because we live in a world where girls are married off as children in the countries, or are otherwise forced into sexual relationship. And we know in many countries, to use the language of an epidemiologist, marriage is the greatest risk factor for being infected with HIV for a young woman. They're actually more infected with HIV than young women who are not married. That's not the case everywhere, but it's the case in some countries because of this, the fact that marriage is with older men who have already been infected and where there is a forced sexual relationship. Thirdly, women and girls still have less access to education in general, and particularly to knowledge about HIV. And that is directly related to the vulnerability to HIV infection. Four, because we still have not gone far enough beyond ABC as the guiding model for HIV prevention. Not that there's something, that anything wrong with ABC, abstinence, being faithful, and using a condom. But when you think of these three letters, none of these is under women's control primarily. And if every woman and man could choose and did choose to follow these three principles, of course we could stop AIDS. But the truth is that most women cannot choose any one of the three. Fifth reason that I see is that because microbicides are still not available because there is insufficient funding. We've made big, big progress, and I see Vida from IPM here, but we need a doubling of the funding for it so that, you know, the development of a microbicide can be accelerated, because that's a very realistic target, and it would mean a revolution. A revolution in heterosexual transmission in the world, if that becomes available at a price that's affordable. And even female condoms are not still universally available. And finally, I would say that AIDS policies and programs are designed without the inclusion of women. And that's the same story. I was at the youth forum this morning, and it's the same story for young people. Programs are designed for them, but programmers forget one detail, and that is that no program will work if the people who are concerned are not consulted and are not involved in it. I would say here also as a man that too little has been done on the ground to encourage men and boys to embrace gender equal norms and behaviors. Because let's face it also, this epidemic is driven by male behavior, whether it is for sexual transmission or for injecting drug use. It is male behavior that is driving it. And so we should be very careful when we translate an analysis of the feminization of the epidemic in what the action is. Part of the action should be that men and boys adopt responsible sexual behavior that is gender sensitive. That's why, for all these reasons, that the Global Coalition on Women and AIDS was launched a couple of years ago, and that earlier this year it launched its agenda for action. It's something that we are fully supporting as UNAIDS. And it's good to see so many members of the Coalition's Leadership Council here, this room today. But what's even more important, I believe, is that there is more and more action on the ground now in countries. For those of you who are not familiar with the agenda, this agenda calls on national governments and the international community to do three things. One, secure women's rights. Two, invest more money in AIDS programs that work for women. And three, increase women's participation in decision-making process. And we believe that action in each of these areas is vital. And particularly if UN member states, governments, are to keep the promises that they made at the end of this year's high-level meeting on AIDS in the General Assembly. Let me remind you what some of these pledges were. And I should underline that whereas the document is disappointing in certain areas, particularly for so-called vulnerable populations, it is a very strong document when it comes to women's rights, to gender, and I think we should use it. It goes further than any other agreed document in the UN system when it comes to gender and women's rights. It says, for example, okay, there are wonderful things that are being promised, eliminate gender inequalities, ensuring that women can exercise the right of control over matters related to sexuality. I'm not going to read all this, but eliminating all types of sexual exploitation, eliminate all forms of violence against women and girls, and so on. So far, so good. But the challenge is to sustain the political commitment and make all this happen. It's like constitutions in a country. They're usually wonderful documents, but it's the enforcement of the law that matters. And that's, in many countries, so dramatically not done when it comes, for example, to sexual violence against women, including within marriage. All this will require consistently strong and, I would say, more daring leadership at every level of society and certainly at the top. And it's time that the women's movement is getting engaged in AIDS. This is one of the big disappointments in my work, because it's not the case. Mainstream women's movement, where it still exists, is not engaged in it. And this leadership must be sustained not for a year or two, but for the next 25 years or more. So I look to all of you to provide this, to lead the way towards concrete action that makes all those pledges a reality, and not just more conference hot air. And coming to the this conference, coming back, I would say that the agenda here is really, as I said, the long-term sustainable response to AIDS, the next 25 years. And to keep the political momentum up in an exceptional way, if we drop the exceptionality of AIDS, funding for treatment of people living with HIV is going to disappear. Funding for microbicide development is going to go down. Harm reduction, sex education in schools, it will all collapse. The Global Fund will not get support anymore that it needs more and more. We also need to make sure that we address the drivers of this epidemic. And again, here is what the women's agenda is important. And I would say for the future and for today, we have two legs to walk on. One is science and technology, grounded in that. The other one is social change. And if we don't have both legs, we will not be able to make progress. So the last thing I would like to say is that we should push everybody dealing with AIDS and ask always that question, does this work for women? Thank you.
I thank Peter Piot for his keynote address, which has given us a direction for this special session, for this high-level session on leadership, time to deliver for women and girls. It will be our task now to focus on that as we move through through the program this afternoon. Following Peter Piot, we would have had two comments or statements. The First Lady of Rwanda, Madame Kagame, was not able to make it due to the air traffic problems we've had, but we are the more pleased to have the First Lady of Honduras with us, and it's my pleasure to introduce to you Madame Iris Xiomara Castro de Zelaya. She was born in Tegucigalpa. She is the second child of five children, born to Mrs. Olga Sarmiento Montoya and Mr. Irene Castro Reyes. She attended Catholic schools during her childhood and married Jose Manuel Zelaya Rosales in January 1976. They have four children. Her further education includes accountability and business administration. She has accompanied her husband on various political activities, focusing on social areas. And we are very pleased that you are with us today and that you are willing to share your thoughts and your commitment with us, Madame.
Muchas gracias. Muy buenas tardes. Ante todo, quisiera agradecer la oportunidad que me han brindado de participar en esta iniciativa y felicitar a la Agencia Canadiense de Desarrollo Internacional y a la Asociación Internacional de SIDA por priorizar desde el inicio de la Conferencia Mundial a las mujeres y a las niñas. No estoy aquí para dar una opinión técnica sobre el VIH-SIDA, sino porque estoy convencida que para poder detener la epidemia debemos de llamar la atención sobre los millones y millones de mujeres y niñas en el mundo que diariamente hacen frente a la inequidad y a la violencia. La vulnerabilidad de la mujer frente a la epidemia no solamente es biológica, es fundamentalmente económica y sociocultural. En nuestras manos está el poder para disminuir los factores que incrementan el riesgo de contraer el VIH y el peso de las consecuencias que este tiene sobre las mujeres. Ustedes se preguntarán por qué yo, la primera dama de Honduras, se ha comprometido con este tema. No es solo porque el SIDA es una de las primeras y principales causas de muerte de mujeres en edad reproductiva de mi país. Es también porque reunidas con mujeres viviendo con el VIH-SIDA, junto con Patricia Pérez, secretaria de la Comunidad Latinoamericana de Mujeres, viviendo con el VIH-SIDA, que está aquí presente, pude conocer un poco de su vida, de sus obstáculos que diariamente enfrentan, la pobreza, la violencia, la discriminación, el estigma. Y la demanda siempre fue la misma en todas ellas, la necesidad de que hayan oportunidades para la mujer. Y pensando en estas mujeres y niñas que llevan adelante la responsabilidad de cuidar a sus familias, de generar ingresos, que hacen sus mayores esfuerzos para evitar infecciones secundarias, que previenen la transmisión del VIH a sus hijos, que son activistas también y líderes en las respuestas del VIH-SIDA, me di cuenta que el compromiso político y el liderazgo son fundamentales para poder establecer alianzas estratégicas que generen esas oportunidades y también para poder alcanzar el empoderamiento de las mujeres para que ellas mismas puedan protegerse del VIH. Por estas razones y porque la respuesta actual a la epidemia es insuficiente para las mujeres y para las niñas, es que he tomado la iniciativa de conformar una coalición de primeras damas y de mujeres líderes de América Latina sobre mujer y VIH-SIDA. Esta alianza, como parte de una coalición global, tiene el anhelo de aunar esfuerzos para abogar por los derechos humanos de las mujeres, influir para que se asignen fondos para programas de prevención y atención de VIH-SIDA, destinados especialmente a ellas, e incidir también para abrir mayores espacios de participación de la mujer en la toma de decisiones. Hoy tenemos un espacio para dialogar, compartir experiencias y plantear también alternativas concretas que nos acerquen a un mundo más equitativo para hombres y mujeres. Yo tengo la firme convicción que detener la amenaza del VIH-SIDA es posible, pero para lograrlo es imprescindible contar con ciudadanas en ejercicio pleno de sus derechos, con poder de decisión, tanto en el ámbito privado como en la esfera pública. Todos debemos de comprender que el progreso de la mujer es el progreso de la humanidad. Muchísimas gracias.
We want to thank the First Lady of Honduras for her statement, which also shows the direction for our discussion. She has been pointing to some very vital issues that we need to develop further in our discussion. Now I have a message which may disappoint some. There should not be a coffee break now. in the preparation for the conference that was in at some time, but I was surprised to see it in the conference which has been in the program which perhaps has been distributed. But if you need coffee from now on and you have someone who assists you, you could have that person go out and get the coffee which is ready outside, or even leave for a moment, but not too long, to bring your coffee in. We'll be very liberal about that. I think we all are eager to continue now and to get into the discussion. And it is my great pleasure to introduce the two co-chairs who will lead us through the next part of the program, both of whom are very committed leaders in their own capacity and in their own context to the struggle to stop the epidemic. And we are very pleased that they have accepted to have this role this afternoon. I introduce to you Heidi Maria Wieczorek-Zeul, Minister of Economic Cooperation and Development of Germany, and Professor Sheila Plew, Minister for Health, Botswana. And these two ladies will guide us through the next session. Please.
Thank you. I'm happy to be with you, and in the spirit of making this a discussion and not reading, you know, I decided that the text that I had prepared, I will distribute so everyone can read whatever he or she is interested in, and perhaps that is an example also to others. You know, it's best that we react to each other's. I wanted just at the beginning to say I'm happy to be here with you. We are dedicated to the topics that we have been discussing, and I have taken what Peter Piot said as a kind of challenge. It's indeed true that the women's movement have to take the question of fight against HIV/AIDS up, and wherever we are, either be we in government or in non-governmental organizations or other initiatives, I think we have to take this as the fight which will last over our lifetime, and the sustainability is the point that has been clearly marked. And I think also congratulating you and commending you that are here, because if you take other fora, I belong to the development committee of the World Bank, I sometimes would be happy to have more women around who can indeed take positions and influence decisions. Those will be points that we are certainly going to discuss. Could I lastly, just for the first part, say Peter Piot has also in a way said those who have given promises should fulfill. I could say that we as German government will raise the funds for fighting HIV/AIDS from so far 300 million euros to 400 million euros for the next years per year, and we show that we are willing to stay and to be sustainable in the fight against HIV/AIDS, because the numbers are so shocking, and specifically the numbers related to women. That was what I just wanted to say at the beginning. And then, could, if you allow me, we ought to say some words on the procedure that we will have to follow for the question of the time management. The maximum time per participant should be 3 minutes in the debate afterwards and in the discussion. And we would have a first speaker, that is Yolanda Simon, from the she's regional coordinator of the Caribbean Regional Network of People Living with HIV/AIDS. And then we would have lead speakers on the 5 key issues that we have in the questions, who will take the floor. And then afterwards, the debate is open for everyone to participate. And you will find in some minutes before you also a possible proposal for a call for action, which of course would not be a consensus document, but might in the end become the call of action and the conclusions of the co-chairs that we have discussed so far. But what it is important is that during this discussion, there should be very concrete points which could be included in such conclusions, because we're here to become very concrete to implement. And once there are concrete proposals, they would be included in the conclusions of the co-chairs. That having said, I think all the technicalities have been dealt with. And could I then call... Sorry, yes, sorry. could I give the floor to the co-chair and afterwards then to Yolanda Simon?
Thank you very much. Yeah, Yolanda will speak. Actually, it's Luis Binder.
Oh,
since Yolanda is not there. But I just wanted to also let you hear my voice as the co-chair. I'll take on later. But I must say that I have been a gender activist more than I have been a minister of health. And having participated in the UN conference, the fourth one in Beijing, this is like 21 years ago. And I must say that I participated in the commissions on the status of women. And, you know, so many years after CEDAW, women are still vulnerable to HIV and AIDS, mainly because when we talk poverty, we talk discrimination. When we talk violence, really the people at the receiving end are the women. I feel it is time to deliver. On my own, I don't know what's going to come up, but I feel the commissions are not enough. We've had too many that too disjointed, that are under-resourced. Stephen Rees is with me on this one. My lobby is for an international agency in the UN, well-resourced in terms of human as well as financial, headed by an Under-Secretary General, and whose main mandate will be to look at the human rights of women. I think that's the only way we're going to have government move. I know I've been an activist. I formed the Society for Women and AIDS in 1988, and we are still here today. We are talking the same thing, and women are still increasingly disappearing. So that's really my stance, and I'm hoping a lot of people will join me in this one. Thank you.
And could I then give the floor to Ms. Binder, please?
Thank you. Your Royal Highness, Your Excellencies, Ministers and colleagues, thank you for the invitation to join in this session on women and girls. First of all, I think the most important strategy that we need to employ if we're going to make changes for women around the world is a strategy of visible leadership, national, international, and then every leader in every type of our community. So to that end, I hope that I'm going to see each and every one of you at the front of our march and rally tomorrow morning at 7 a.m. I understand even CNN will be covering it, so that the world can see visibly your leadership and your support for what will be a historic march. So that's my first point. You could call it an unpaid advertisement. The second point is that we require, in my view, countrywide strategies. Of course, international work needs to be done, and I'll speak a bit about that, but mostly what we truly, truly need are countrywide strategies. They can, and they must be multi-stakeholder, and they must have leaders from all important sectors, including political, medical, bureaucratic, religious, cultural, healthcare, and most importantly of all, women at the head of the table at those important strategic sessions. And it is very important that we do not consider ourselves as women to be victims, vectors, and vessels, but leaders. And you cannot force us to be empowered, but you can create an environment where those of us who wish self-empowerment can take self-empowerment. This does not mean, by the way, the creation of strategies that mainstream women's issues, nor ghettoize women's issues, but rather they actually create integration, recognizing unique issues where they exist for women, including gender inequality and socioeconomic status of women. They must be comprehensive strategies, they must be sustained strategies, and well-resourced. Now, what do those strategies have to contain? They cannot just be siloed to HIV. They must, of course, be a comprehensive set of strategies related to HIV, and in each case, looking through the gender lens, from prevention, care, treatment, and support, research, all the way through. But they must not be siloed, and in fact, must be contained within a broader health context, and particularly full reproductive rights and health for women must be a part of those strategies. And they can also not be siloed from development issues, which are real gender inequality issues. So we must have education for women, and if that means getting rid of school fees and other costs that get women into schools and keep them there, we must get rid of those. We must train our women. We must give them the opportunity for microfinance and other opportunities to be employed. We must ensure that they have housing, because one of the other terrible pandemics in this world is the pandemic of violence against women. It stops women from getting out of situations which would allow themselves to prevent HIV for themselves, and it also makes them frightened to take treatment, care, and support that would be available to them should they be HIV positive. We must ensure that every country has inheritance rights for women. We must ensure that every country has property rights for women. We must ensure that every country has laws against violence, that women are educated about their rights in all of these areas, including treatment literacy, and that the judiciary and the police and all of these other areas as well must be educated to deal with women. We must decriminalize the sex trade, and we must have comprehensive harm reduction as part of these strategies, absolutely. We must have support for our caregivers as well, because so many women are. And my last point is this, and it's to the donors. It's the international point that I'd like to make. Donors must absolutely remove the strings that they put on funding for people. Those strings are ropes around women's necks, and they are killing us. And you must give us the money, and you must accept that these strategies that are countrywide and have all the intelligent people in that country will know how to use that funding. And it must be used both for prevention and for treatment, because neither is successful without the other. And we must have a balance of both. Thank you.
I would like to call as the lead speaker on the existing AIDS strategies, Horace Daly, Minister of Health from Jamaica. Is she around?
He's not around.
He's not around. Then I take it that we would have to call on Julio Frank Mora, who is Minister of Health, who would speak on the access to services. Minister of Health, Mexico.
Yes, thank you.
I'm sorry, just to tell, the thing is, you know, sometimes people have come who were supposed to come and some have not come, and there is a change sometimes. But we're happy to have you here, and you have the floor.
Madam Chair, you want the topic of access, I take it, and I will be happy to do that. Of Mexico, if my colleague from Jamaica has not arrived, Her Royal Highness, Excellencies, colleagues, I would, in this very brief introduction to the topic of access to services, I would like to share some reflections on concrete experiences in my own country, both in fighting HIV/AIDS and also in adopting a gender perspective into health policies, and derive from those some global lessons. The main point I would make in this introduction is that any comprehensive strategy to deal with HIV/AIDS must take into account the added challenges posed by gender inequities. And this is both in countries where the epidemic is rapidly becoming feminized and also in countries where it is still concentrated among men. This is so because the tendency for HIV/AIDS to disproportionately affect the socially marginalized becomes exacerbated in women, and hence the epidemic both reflects and magnifies gender inequities. A comprehensive approach to HIV/AIDS, in my view, must be based on three pillars, as we have done in Mexico. First, prevention. Second, universal access to comprehensive quality care, including antiretroviral therapy. And third, the fight against discrimination and stigma. And each of those pose special challenges in dealing with women. On prevention, the main challenge is that many women, other than commercial sex workers, underestimate the risk of infection and demand detection services infrequently or too late, only when they realize that the partner is infected or sick. For this reason, a key strategy is to link prevention against HIV infection to health services that women demand with higher frequency, especially, although not exclusively, those related to reproductive and sexual health. It is essential to take advantage of every contact with the health system to develop preventive actions against HIV/AIDS, including information and opportunities for testing. Today in Mexico, we're committed to offering rapid detection tests to every pregnant woman as a routine component of antenatal and delivery care. If tests are positive, then antiretroviral therapy is guaranteed. Preventive and testing opportunities must also be extended to offer to other ambulatory and hospital services for women, such as family planning, cancer detection, etc. We are training health workers to assure that these opportunities are fully taken advantage of. An additional challenge on the prevention side relates to gender roles that limit the participation of women in decisions concerning preventive measures, such as condom use by the partner. This is worsened by sexual violence within or outside the relationship with a partner. To face such challenges, my country has implemented an action program called Women and Health, which includes interventions to empower women, and I would just emphasize two of them that have already been mentioned. The first is, of course, the promotion of methods to prevent sexually transmitted infections that can be controlled by women, such as the female condom. I think that a priority for national and international action must be to reduce economic and other barriers to access to these methods. Also, more research and development is needed to provide women with a wider array of alternatives in this regard, including microbicides, as was mentioned already by Dr. Pjot. The second, apart from this element, the second key intervention refers to specific models for reducing violence against women through, as we've done in Mexico, through the training of personnel in detection of signs of violence, treatment of physical and emotional sequelae, counseling, cooperation with civil society to establish shelters, and broad intersectorial policies dealing with education and justice, again, as we have just heard. I hope we will be discussing this topic in greater depth, and particularly would like to point out that migrant women are a especially vulnerable population, and that the linkage between migration and AIDS is, I believe, a critical topic of our time that I hope, again, we will discuss during our roundtable. So these are some of the challenges on the first pillar of prevention. On access to treatment, the second pillar, a cultural or economic, women are often discriminated in access to health services generally, and more specifically to care for AIDS. Again, there's evidence about discrimination in the level of quality, and both personal and technical quality. One of the key elements here, and it's the topic of this introduction, is to expand access to treatment. In Mexico, we have introduced an innovative universal insurance scheme for poor persons called Popular Health Insurance, or Seguro Popular, that provides accelerated universal coverage to comprehensive treatment against AIDS, including ART. And this illustrates what we just heard about not siloing the fight or the treatment against AIDS, but rather resolving the traditional fight between vertical and horizontal approaches through designing a diagonal approach in which specific priorities, such as treatment against AIDS, become the driving force to introduce overall improvements in the health system. Finally, I would like to very briefly refer to the third pillar, fight against discrimination. Clearly, HIV/AIDS compounds other sources of discrimination against women, and therefore we need action based on a human rights perspective. In Mexico, we have worked closely with civil society organizations, both in dealing with HIV/AIDS and with gender equity. As a result, Congress has approved an increase of 14 times in the budget, both for prevention, treatment, and fight against discrimination, has made a constitutional amendment and a specific law to prevent and combat discrimination with a special body charged with this mandate, which has been working with our National AIDS Council in an extensive award-winning campaign to combat discrimination and stigma. Mutual reinforcement among the three pillars will be, in my opinion, the only way to face this crisis, and in doing so, to improve the overall condition of women worldwide. Global cooperation is essential to improve this juncture of gender and health, which are two key dimensions of the search for equity in our common world. Thank you.
Thank you, and on women's rights, it would be Mary Robinson, who is present and who I give the floor to. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and actually, I'm very happy to follow the lead from this corner already, and to say, yes, we need visible women's leadership and visible leadership on the issues, and I was reflecting that we know what a human rights approach is, and it's part of the agenda of the UN Global Coalition on Women and AIDS, and the agenda on action for women and AIDS, which we all have. It's about women being there in the planning, being at the decision making. It's about addressing all of the human rights issues that we know about. And what I was thinking is, if we're going to have a call to action from this group, then we need to build in systems of accountability, not just rhetoric anymore, but actually accountability of what women leaders will do when they're in positions of power. And we're trying to widen that circle. Musimbi Kinyora and myself are bringing in businesswomen to, because business women have power in their societies. And as Peter Piot pointed out, a lot of the vulnerability, particularly of young girls, is about power relationships. And so we have to address these power relationships. We have to have women's voices linking with those who don't have the same power. But we also need to do the practical agenda, the Beijing agenda, as was said, about women's rights, about property and inheritance rights, about violence against women, about discrimination, about what happens when it's discovered that a woman is positive, a mother is positive, she gets the blame and gets thrown out of her home. Who's there to help her? And I have learned an awful lot from the international community of women living with AIDS about how many barriers and how much discrimination they face, and also how proactive they are as not so much victims, as was said, but change agents, actors for change. And seeing what very poor women will do in their communities when they have nobody else to help them, fall back on themselves, group in groups of three or five that become local communities, local networking, the way in which that can change the local circumstances. So we need visible leadership. We do need to be it needs to be country-centred, and there need to be accountability mechanisms. One suggestion I would make, because I think it might help, is to encourage governments to be prepared to have some kind of an independent oversight of what they are doing in this area. Are they taking a gender approach? Are they bringing in legislation to combat domestic violence, and are they implementing that legislation? Are they changing the property laws, the inheritance laws? Are they empowering women? Have they women at the table? And on funding, all of the funds need to look again at whether they are sufficiently putting gender at the centre. In other words, I like the tone that has been set from the chair, from the co-chairs of this meeting. We want to be practical. We want accountability. We know what will make a difference. Can we, in our call to action, maybe make a checklist of what governments should be adhering to, what donors should be adhering to, what civil society should be putting at the prioritising in their agenda, particularly the women's movement, and hold everybody accountable. That, I think, would reinforce the human rights dimension. We know that we will not combat this huge pandemic unless we take a rights approach. We know practically what that means. We need more accountability. Thank you.
I'd like to call on Elena Salgado, who is Minister of Health from Spain. There she is. Please. On the question of participation.
Thank you very much. Muy buenas tardes a todos. La epidemia es ya mayoritariamente femenina, como nos ha recordado el doctor Piot. Y sin embargo, las mujeres están subrepresentadas o incluso ausentes de los sitios, de los lugares donde se deciden las políticas y donde se asignan los recursos. Quisiera darles un dato. Solo se han encontrado mujeres implicadas en el desarrollo de las estrategias nacionales contra el VIH-Sida en menos del 10% de los países que respondieron a la encuesta que recientemente realizó ONU-Sida. Pero además, la mayoría de quienes toman las decisiones importantes, políticas, gerenciales o profesionales, son hombres. Y además, hombres en cuyo entorno personal y social no se suele padecer, al menos de manera directa, ni la enfermedad ni sus consecuencias. Cuando esto es así, el riesgo de que las estrategias de lucha contra el SIDA sean poco efectivas para las mujeres es muy alto. Y por eso hay que reforzar el enfoque de género, hay que dar más presencia a las mujeres, no solo en los órganos de decisión sobre las estrategias y los fondos para luchar contra el SIDA, sino sobre todo donde se formulan las políticas públicas de salud, de educación, de comunicación de recursos, donde se asignan los presupuestos. Y eso incluye a los gobiernos, pero también al poder legislativo, al Poder Judicial y a las administraciones locales. Particularmente es importante que las organizaciones de mujeres afectadas o que se ocupan de mujeres que viven con VIH-Sida participen activamente en los organismos nacionales que elaboran las políticas contra el SIDA y también en las propuestas que los gobiernos someten a los organismos internacionales de cooperación. Y es tarea de los gobiernos estimular esta participación. Pero también hay que reforzar la presencia de mujeres allí donde se generan y difunden el conocimiento y la opinión, en las universidades, en los centros de investigación, en las corporaciones profesionales y en los medios de comunicación. Para lograr este objetivo hace falta voluntad política y también cambios legislativos. Hay que cambiar mentalidades y hábitos de siglos. En gran parte del mundo las mujeres tienen menor acceso a la educación, a la información, incluso a la información sobre VIH-SIDA. Las mujeres son más pobres, carecen de independencia económica, no tienen igualdad jurídica con los hombres y no tienen tampoco autonomía a la hora de decidir sobre sus relaciones sexuales. Y esto no es solo un problema de los países menos adelantados. En los países más desarrollados sigue habiendo grandes desigualdades en el acceso a los mercados de trabajo, en la distribución de los tiempos de trabajo y ocio y en el reparto de las cargas familiares entre hombres y mujeres. Por eso, la Coalición Mundial sobre Mujeres y el SIDA ha constatado que las estrategias actualmente en vigor son insuficientes y por eso uno de los puntos de su programa, Más puestos decisivos para las mujeres, promueve la presencia de mujeres en los más altos niveles del Estado, de los organismos internacionales y de las organizaciones no gubernamentales que trabajan para conseguir el control de la epidemia. Y quiero decirles que mi país, seguramente, el hecho de formar un gobierno paritario con igual número de hombres que de mujeres ha hecho mucho contra la discriminación de la mujer en todos los campos. Es evidente que esta tarea, dar más participación a las mujeres, nos exige a todos un esfuerzo adicional, porque las mujeres tienen menos educación y, por tanto, tendremos que hacer esfuerzos en su formación para que puedan actuar como verdaderos líderes en estos campos. Porque sin introducir el enfoque de género en las políticas públicas, sin aumentar la participación de las mujeres, no habrá progresos importantes en la lucha contra el VIH-SIDA. Porque no hay recetas milagrosas. Se requiere voluntad y perseverancia. Las organizaciones de mujeres pueden aportar su experiencia, en particular diciéndonos sobre cuáles son los mensajes más apropiados, las formas mejores para que esos mensajes lleguen a las mujeres, sobre cómo incorporar más mujeres, jóvenes y adultas a esta lucha, para aprovechar al máximo los cauces pequeños que ya existen, para eliminar las barreras, para reclamar nuevas vías de participación. Solo eliminando la violencia y la discriminación de género, la incomprensión y la ignorancia, vamos a poder reducir el riesgo de contagio, pero solo aumentando la capacidad de decidir de las mujeres y su participación activa, vamos a poder vencer al VIH-SIDA. En este momento, y gracias a los esfuerzos de muchos, el VIH-SIDA está en la agenda global. No dejemos pasar esta oportunidad. El conocimiento y la participación de las mujeres son nuestros instrumentos más poderosos. Debemos utilizarlos, no debemos dejarlos atrás. Solo así tendremos éxito. Muchas gracias.
Next speaker is Musimbi Kanyoro, is General Secretary of World YWCA.
Your Highness, Your Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen. For the last 25 years, we have realized that there's no single player who alone can make achievements in regards to HIV. We have realized that the only way we can succeed is to work together. And therefore, today I want to speak about participation. But I want to say that if we want to talk about participation of women, if we want to bring women to the table, then we also need to change the table rules. We need to have different table manners. And one of the table manners that we need to change immediately is to stop talking about women as if women were objects, doing nothing and just suffering, because women are doing a lot of things. And therefore, I want to encourage the first change of the table manners by telling you some of the important things that women are doing all over the world in regards to HIV. We all know and have heard over and over in this country, made popular by Stephen Lewis, about the work of the grandmothers all over the world in their caring for people that are ill, for the orphans, and for the children. These are women, and they are doing something. I know that the only organization that is documenting the lives of women in Africa, and I dare lift Africa up because it's one of the continents where it is talked about in terms of the deficit all over. And yet I know that when I look at that continent, which is also my continent, if someone who does not live on that continent is given just one day to use that day and do what the women of Africa do, I don't think that you will survive. Women are doing something. And on that continent, the only organization that is documenting the lives of women affected by war, by poverty, ISIS is situated in Uganda, and there we can find many records of what is happening to women. They are doing something. What I want to say in participation, I see three areas that are important when you invite people to participate. First, you must realize that the people will change the nature of that table. If women come to the table, then the table will have to look different, not just by how they look, but how they think and what they bring to that table. Women are going to ask different questions from the questions that are being asked on that table. Women are going to be concerned, for example, that we don't leave children away, that we make sure that the mothers are kept alive when we are talking about HIV, that we make sure that everyone is fed on the table, not just the women and the children, but the whole family, because women are caretakers. Women are also going to say, we have to put implementation to the words that we make. Every one of us, wherever we are, has some budget, and we can't talk about lack of money for women if we don't make our own budgets speak for women. An example is that when we decided in my own organization, the YWCA, that we shall use 60% of all our money to support what women are doing in HIV and AIDS, we have risen to the work of in 73 countries on HIV and AIDS, covering every part of this continent. But it's because we made a decision that we shall back up and support those people that are working on HIV/AIDS financially and look for resources to support them. Another small example that I would like to use for participation where we can really be able to implement is that we have other properties. We have buildings, we have churches, we have mosques, we have different things, we have synagogues. These buildings stay unused when women cannot have a place to have meetings. In the YWCA, for example, we said everywhere where we have a building, if positive women are asking for a place to meet, they will have that place free and have a meeting there. It is a resource. And this is one way of participation, of encouraging people to have a way of participating. And yesterday in this country, in Canada, positive women met at the Toronto YWCA because they knew that that is their place. And we can make the resources be able to do a lot more for us by using the kind of resources that we have on the ground. And the third one that I want to use that we have found very useful is investing in young people. The future of our work depends on young people. How many young people are on this table invited specifically to come and speak for themselves? When I look around, we are not very young, including myself. In the YWCA, we believe in young people. So we make policies and say we shall not meet unless we have a reasonable percentage of young people. No meeting will take place with less than 25% of young people, and no board will be set up internationally
with less than 50% of young people. These policies ensure for us that participation will continue. And finally, we must teach our own communities that we work with how to work with GIPA, greater involvement of people living with AIDS or people living with HIV. This does not come naturally. We have to be able to teach it, to enable mistakes to be made and those mistakes corrected, but we can only do so if we show by example that every government seat, every church, every particular form of leadership, they are in that group, people who are living with HIV, and they themselves are doing the education that is needed in our place. That is what participation is about. It's about making ourselves accountable even before we have tools for accountability. And it is this kind of participation that I have found as a leader, as one of the leaders in the Global Coalition of Women, that we can be able to talk of participation that helps women to participate because their human rights have been respected, to participate because there are resources that back up their work, to participate because there is a place at the table, and on that table, there are good manners on the table. Thank you.
Last speaker in this round of introduction is Nolleen Hayser from UNIFEM.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, Your Royal Highness, and members of the round table. It has been 25 years since we've been dealing with this pandemic, and 30 years that women have put the issue of gender equality and women's human rights on the table. We can celebrate progress in terms of the awareness that we have, in terms of some of the policies that we have changed, in terms of some of the laws that we have changed, but this progress is far too slow. It is too slow when we still have data that says that women, and especially young girls, young women between the age of 16 to 24, get infected 6 times more than boys in some parts of Africa and in some parts of the world. This is not accepted. It is too slow when grandmothers still have to take care of orphans, and when the number of orphans have grown from 12 million to 15 million just from 2 years ago. It is too slow when many widows are still pushed out of their land and out of their property because they are stigmatized. When positive women and women who are affected do not have the space of shaping the policies that affect their lives, and their strategies are not invested in. Now, what are some of the things that we can do to accelerate change? Because we cannot wait for another 25 years. What needs to be put in place? I have 6 suggestions coming from our engagement with women. As many of you have heard, it's time to end violence against women, not just in situation of war, when rape is used as a weapon of war and women do not have any way of getting out of that cycle, but in times of peace, because what we accept in times of peace indicates what we will accept in times of conflict. We have to end violence against women now and forever. And I'm very happy to say that private sector is coming in to invest in this strategy with UNIFEM, and I just want to mention the support that we've been getting from Johnson and Johnson in the context of the Coalition of Women and AIDS. Secondly, many countries can do this action, and this is to eliminate once and for all laws that discriminate against women. There is no place for any law that discriminates against women in the 21st century, from property rights, from employment strategies, from family codes, and so on. We have to make that history. Thirdly, it is not all right to have laws, but not to implement them. And when it comes to lives of women, to then ensure that it goes into the informal sector of courts, the customary courts or customary practices, and there are no proper legal systems of implementation. So laws are there, but they need to be implemented. Our institutions can change, and there is no excuse. Just a few months ago, I visited the Indian Railways, and I was told by the Director General at that time that when some of my staff went to see him, he said, "Why are you here? We only have men who are employed by our railways." And we said, "That's why we are here. We are here because we want you to change the way in which this system can support your employees who are living with HIV/AIDS and the wives of women, and the wives of men who have died of HIV/AIDS. I'm very happy to say that the railway system, employing 1.3 million people today, have broken stigma and silence to reach out to 1.3 million employees, and many of the men are now receiving free drugs, and many of the widows are now brought in and employed. Change can happen, but they need to be upscale and they need to be invested in. And I'm very happy to say that the Chinese railway have decided to learn from the Indian railways. There are things that can happen, but we need to put the energy and the investment behind it. There has to be change at the behavior and attitudinal level, at the community level where things happen. And I was very happy when I visited a community in Zimbabwe, when I saw how happy the men were when they wore a T-shirt receiving me, "We are caregivers." It is not all right anymore for women to have the burden of care. The men can come in. And I was very happy to see the discussions that they have had and that the positive women are in fact running the HIV/AIDS communities, and many of the action plans have their voices and strategies. We have to invest in space and in participation. The people who carry the burden of care, the people who are infected, should be the ones to shape the policies and the plans. And I was very happy to partner with the Positive Women's Network to make sure that they had a space at every table. Finally, it is not all right to know strategies that work, because we do know. I don't think we can go around today to say that we do not know what strategies work. We do know what strategies work. But what is it? What is holding us back so that our strategies cannot keep pace with the spread of the pandemic? It is still the fear of upscaling the resources and the investment to make sure that those strategies are large enough and deep enough for the transformation that needs to happen in the legal policy framework, in our institutions, in our attitudes, in our behavior, and in our pockets. There are not enough resources going to where it should go. Money matters, and money at the end of the day is what we have to make sure reach the people who have made the strategies work. And finally, accountability mechanisms. We need to have the right data, the indicators, the monitoring and the tracking systems, and none better than to have the positive women and the affected women tracking what is happening at the community level. We can make things happen. We cannot wait another 25 years, and I know that with your leadership and commitment, this will happen today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I must thank all the presenters. We're now getting into a different part of the session, where we're going to have people volunteer to speak. If they don't volunteer, I have a nice list where I'll be able to call upon them. But I'm sure we're all here to come and share. We want to share our experiences and to really share especially what works. How can strategies be adapted to be more effective? How can women be more involved in fora, in AIDS policies are decided? And of course, measures taken to empower women, as well as how do we scale up PMTCT, antenatal care, education, and giving health information, etc. So I'm going to open the floor so that people can give us in 2 minutes what you think can work. And I will be very strict. People, I am a professor. You know, when I say two, I mean two. So it will be that. I'll be able to thank you for your participation. So with that, I'm hoping then that there will be no red statements. We want a statement from the bottom of your heart, not something that was written for you. So let's be more spontaneous and share with each other. So with that, I'm opening the floor. But I'll open it by calling upon my own sister, Honorable Minister for HIV/AIDS in the Presidency of Burundi, Dr. Tryphonie Nkurunziza. So you start the floor and then the others will volunteer. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Merci, Sheila. De me forcer la par... Vous ne me forcez pas de parler, je voulais parler. Moi, je voudrais parler à propos des jeunes filles et des fillettes. Je voudrais axer mon intervention sur la prévention. Je dois vous dire qu'avant d'être ministre en charge de la lutte contre le sida, j'étais professeure à l'université et j'étais gynécologue. Et je sais ce que je parle par rapport aux fillettes et aux filles. Je pense que nous avons, les filles doivent avoir plus de conscience du risque d'être contaminé par les infections sexuellement transmissibles et le sida. Il est absolument essentiel que les filles et les fillettes aient accès à l'information et très tôt. Je voudrais vous donner un exemple dans mon pays. Nous avons fait la première enquête de séroprévalence en 2000 et nous avons trouvé que les adolescentes étaient 4 fois plus infectées que les adolescents et les femmes de 15 à 24, 44 ans l'étaient 2 fois plus. Mais la question qui se pose, est-ce que les femmes connaissent cette histoire? Est-ce que les femmes ont cette information pour agir à temps? Je pense donc qu'il est essentiel de donner l'information à temps pour que les filles se réveillent de leur inertie, c'est ce que je pourrais dire. Moi, j'ai beaucoup d'expérience de la négligence de la santé sexuelle des filles, parce que quand je les vois en consultation, j'ai l'impression que vraiment, elles ne sont pas impliquées, ne sont pas engagées dans leur santé. Parce que quand je vois, par exemple, une fille qui vient me voir parce qu'elle a une grossesse non désirée, moi, je lui demande pourquoi vous n'avez pas pris la pilule? Pourquoi vous n'avez pas utilisé le préservatif? Et elle me dit, de façon assez légère, je n'y pensais pas, je ne pensais pas que je pouvais être enceinte, je ne pensais pas que je pouvais attraper l'infection. Et je trouve que c'est une grande lacune qui est propre aux femmes et aux filles. Je ne pense pas que les hommes puissent nous aider. Nous devons nous-mêmes faire cette action. Nous devons aimer notre corps, nous devons prendre en charge notre sexualité. Ça, c'est l'une de mon intervention. Je voudrais dire aussi que les femmes ont beaucoup de pouvoir, mais elles ne le savent pas. Et quand elles le savent, elles manquent cruellement de moyens, de ressources. Dans mon pays, ce sont les femmes qui ont créé les premières associations de prise en charge des personnes vivant avec le VIH. Et depuis qu'elles ont commencé à prendre en charge les personnes vivant avec le VIH, je peux vous dire que 60% des personnes qui ont le traitement antirétroviral est donné par ces associations de femmes. Mais ça, c'est une grande, grande, je veux dire, c'est un grand engagement et c'est un signe d'empouvoir que nous avons, nous les femmes. Mais je voudrais dire que nous devons être financées. Les femmes qui ont des actions aussi intéressantes doivent être financées. C'est pourquoi je rejoins la demande du professeur Chou pour créer une agence internationale qui ait donné des fonds aux femmes. Je vous remercie.
Merci beaucoup. Monsieur, vous avez pris 3 minutes, mais ça c'est bien. Okay, our next speaker is from the International Community of Women Living with HIV/AIDS, Marie-José Vasquez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I am the chair of the International Community of Women Living with HIV and AIDS, which is the only global network of run by and for HIV-positive women. Our main objective is to give support to HIV-positive women worldwide and to raise the women's voices and make them heard at decision-making places. At this conference, the International Community of Women Living with HIV and AIDS wants to challenge all delegates to think about the meaning behind words by proposing five key challenges that you will be hearing about in the next 5 days. And it is also what we are going to try to do here by asking you to look at how the five areas proposed here for discussion can take us to oversimplifying the issues we are trying to address by not taking into account the diverse reality of women all over the world, and especially those of women living with HIV and AIDS. We feel that all five areas are very broad and should be unpacked and brought more deeply in a way that they will be more adequately addressed, leaving behind traditionally monolithic assumptions that showed of no use in the past. Let's take, for instance, women's sexual rights. We consider it is absolutely necessary that it is wholly acknowledged that it is not possible to limit our vision to safety issues, pregnancy, delivery, STI prevention and treatment. It is of foremost importance that we focus in the right of women to have knowledge about their own bodies and the search for pleasure. Pleasure has been left aside in dealing with prevention and health in most cases, although we considered that it should be recognized as crucial for women to live their lives to the fullest. When talking about scaling up services, again, it is necessary that this talk is not limited to access in terms of statistics, reducing women to numbers. We need to think of creating enabling environments for women and explore ways in which these environments facilitate both within and without and outside health services, the achievement of women's health and health rights. You ask, how can women be involved where AIDS policies are decided? And you will get a first piece of information that you can reflect upon by looking at who is around this table. The last report UNAIDS has just launched informs about the little advance has been done in the reduction of stigma and discrimination, and this can be easily seen in this meeting. How many openly HIV-positive women have been invited to this meeting? How much time will we dedicate to learn about women's realities as told by themselves? Where are women IBU injecting drug users or sexual workers or prisoners? Where are they represented? HIV-positive women are actively working in their communities, in their churches, working places, etc. So we are far from hidden, far from silent. We are doing our individual and collective work wherever it's needed. So we want to ask you, how many of the various sessions where HIV-positive women are talking about themselves and the work they do have you included in your agenda? Have you planned to share with us, with HIV-positive women, the multiple activities that are going to take place in the Global Village? There is where you can listen to us in the first place, because participation is not just a one-way road. So making ours the theme of the conference, we invite you all to our meetings, where you will not find the same restrictions that most women find when having to share with you here in these high-level meetings. ICW has been invited to this table, and we had to ask for the word because we were not accorded a time in the presentations. So thank you very much to you all.
Thank you very much. The next person we're hearing from is Zhang Weijing, the Minister of National Population and Family Planning from China. Ni hao.
Thank you, Chair. 女士们、先生们, 非常高兴啊, 应邀参加本届 为妇女和女孩履行承诺时候到了的高层研讨会。 根据中国卫生部 联合国艾滋病规划署 和世界卫生组织今年1月发布的报告， 中国现在的艾滋病感染者 人数为65万人， 占总人口的 0.05%。 艾滋病的流行 正处在由高危人群向普通人群扩散，性接触传播和母婴传播比例呈上升的趋势，女性艾滋病感染者所占比例有较大幅度的增加，在感染人群中，女性的总感染 占79%，艾滋病的快速蔓延和传播，特别是女性感染者的增加，正在危害着中国人民，特别是妇女的生命健康和人口安全。中国是一个有13亿人口的发展中国家。 中国政府把艾滋病的防治工作作为关系国家经济发展、社会稳定、国家安全和民族兴衰的战略问题，建立了政府领导、部门配合、社会参与的工作机制，制定并实施了1998年到2010年 中国预防和控制艾滋病的中长期规划。 2001年到2015年 中国遏制和防治艾滋病行动计划，确立并实施了四免除一关怀的一系列政策措施。今年 中国政府又制定了艾滋病防治条例的行政法规，3月1日开始实施，同时也制定了2006年到2010年的行动计划，明确了今后5年防治艾滋病的目标、原则、防治策略 和保障措施。女士们、先生们，社会性别不平等是导致艾滋病在妇女中加速蔓延的重要原因。女性艾滋病病毒感染者和患者数量的增多，必然会导致母婴传播途径感染的婴儿数量增多， 直接危害到妇女的健康、家庭的幸福和社会的和谐。把计划生育、生殖健康与防治艾滋病结合起来，提高育龄妇女的生命质量和生活质量，是有效防治艾滋病的成功经验。 中国政府充分认识到在预防
以控制艾滋病工作中要更多的关注妇女、关注女孩的重要意义，充分认识到计划生育、生殖健康与艾滋病的有机结合的重要性和紧迫性。 2005年，由中国中央宣传部、卫生部、人口计生委、全国妇联四个部门联合发起了关注妇女抗击艾滋的行动计划。这个行动计划的主要目标是。 在全社会加强宣传教育，普及艾滋病性病的防治知识，实现妇女赋权，消除歧视，推动社会性别平等，帮助妇女普及艾滋病防治知识，增加妇女获得艾滋病治疗、关怀和救助的机会。因为时间关系呢。 我就不可能全讲了，下面我简单说一下，艾滋病防治工作不仅仅是公共卫生问题，是国际社会共同关注的社会发展问题，也是事关人类生存和发展的人口安全问题。我们应当共同携起手来，并肩作战，通过各国政府的共同努力。 让全世界越来越多的母亲、妻子和女儿远离艾滋病的侵害，让越来越多的妇女拥有健康的身体、幸福的家庭，为人类共同实现《人发大会行动纲领》和千年发展目标而奋斗。Thank you.
谢谢。谢谢。I was already just about to die, Minister. Thank you very much. 谢谢。谢谢。 Okay, to make this better, it looks like everybody wants to speak. So I'm going to tell you the next six speakers. That way I'll ask them to put down their signs, and then we can have an idea who else is left. So, okay. First on the list, Dr. Kami, Minister of Health, Namibia. Then HIV/AIDS Ambassador, Netherlands, Paul Beckers. Then Dr. Parina Nyatwa, Minister of Health, Zimbabwe. Then HIV/AIDS Ambassador, Sweden, Leonard Heilmacher. Mrs. Joy Pumapi, Assistant Director General, WHO. And last, Africa Development Bank, Hilga Johnson. So we'll have those six first, and then we'll have the others. And yes, I will interrupt you, so please keep to the time. As you can see, everybody wants to say something. Okay. Dr. Kang, you're on.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chairperson. I wish to make a contribution on this very important subject, time to deliver for women and girls, and to share our own experience as a country. Namibia, just like many other countries, has a long history of gender inequalities. Discrimination has been hindering the progress of women in economic, social, and political areas. The Namibian Constitution explicitly discourages any form of discrimination on the basis of gender. Thus, since 1990, the Namibian government has been committed to addressing gender inequality, and this led to the establishment of the Ministry of Women Affairs and Child Welfare in 2000. Unfortunately, men had to complain. Thus, as we talk now, we now have a Ministry of Gender Equality and Child Welfare, addressing all. Namibia is committed to the goals of the International Conference on Population and Development, Principles on Reproductive Health. Co-Chairperson, clearly my country, HIV prevalence rate, among pregnant women stands at 19.7%. And that in the whole country, 51% of those who are infected are indeed women. Now, what are we doing to address this problem? The Namibian government has introduced a number of programs for women and girls, including the prevention of mother-to-child transmission in all public and private hospitals. Female condoms and sex education are in place. And that during 2005, we had up to 4,710 HIV-positive women received prophylaxis. In 2003, Namibia rolled out antiretroviral treatment, and that currently we have up to 22,000 people are on ART, of which 64% are our women folk. It is important, yes, I want to share with other colleagues that laws and legislation are indeed important in addressing this problem. Thus, Namibia has signed and ratified several regional and international instruments, such as the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women. The Beijing Declaration and Platform, obviously, is in place. The African Regional Platform for Action and the African Charter on Women's Rights, SADC Declaration on Gender and Development, and its addendum on prevention and eradication of violence against women and children, all of which upholds the principles of gender equality. At national level, laws and policies that have been enacted to address gender inequality are Married Persons Equality Act in 1996, Combating of Rape Act of 2000, Combating of Domestic Violence Act of 2003, Maintenance Act of 2003, Affirmative Action are all in place, and we are making it a point that these laws are respected. To address gender-based violence in the country that affects women and children, the government has created a number of women and child protection units in all our 13 regions. For this program to succeed, it calls for behavioral change among menfolk. Co-chairperson, in the area of education, which is equally important, great progress is being made by making education free and accessible for all boys and girls at primary level. The effectiveness of Namibia's primary schooling system has also improved over the past decade. Girls continue to outnumber boys in secondary education. That for every 100 boys, as we talk now, Minister, in secondary school, now 113. Co-chairperson, it's important to know that we menfolk are assisting and are contributing to make sure our women folks are indeed in the system. Finally, while acknowledging progress made in addressing gender inequality, challenge to empower women and girls and funding for programs related to the increasing numbers of orphans and vulnerable children remains. Thank you, Co-Chairperson. It's important to mention some of the things. Huh?
Thank you very much, Honourable Minister. Challenges do still remain, indeed. My next presenter is Paul Beckers, HIV-AIDS Ambassador, Netherlands.
Yeah, thank you very much, Madam Chair. Thank you for the Government of Canada for hosting us. Madam Chair, I'll be brief. I have one remark. As usual, it was very enlightening to listen to Dr. Piot's introduction earlier this afternoon. When he was talking about the drivers of the epidemic, the unequal position of women, I think one of the first reasons to be mentioned for us not being able to solve it is that the world community is not taking financing of the AIDS response serious enough as far as the gender issue is concerned. I'm afraid Dr. Piot was using an understatement here. We all know that sexual and reproductive health and rights play a pivotal role in addressing the gender issue vis-à-vis the AIDS response. And while we see, luckily, that there's a vast increase of funding for HIV/AIDS, we'll actually see a decline in funding for sexual and reproductive health and rights. Madam Chair, women have the right to be informed and to have access to safe, effective, affordable, acceptable methods of family planning and have the right of access to appropriate health care services. So in response to the questions on the table, my plea is simple. We just need much more funding for sexual reproductive health and rights. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I have to clap to that, because I'm hoping other people follow your way. Exact to the point. Thank you very much. My next presenter is my own brother, who I will stop if he tries. Honorable Minister Parire Nyatwa from Zimbabwe.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Yes, I think this is a very important conference for us, and I really would like to appreciate and thank the Government of Canada for calling us here. It is important for us because in Africa, and particularly in Southern Africa, the epicenter of the epidemic is in Southern Africa. And I think to us, it's critical. Our governments in that region have shown a lot of commitment, and we're pleased that we still continue to fight the challenges in our countries. And these challenges include, of course, the issue of poverty among our people and food security, which relates to nutrition that goes very well to fighting HIV and AIDS. But gender inequalities in Zimbabwe are reflected in the sense that 59% of our women, of those who are positive, 59% are women. And that, again, to me, is a big challenge. And as a Minister of Health and Child Welfare in Zimbabwe, we also continue to fight the issue of stigma and the issue that we need resources. And those resources reflect in the poverty that we've talked about. But as we fight HIV and AIDS, we also look at our traditional norms that we fight, that militate, that sometimes promote HIV and AIDS, particularly wife inheritance, and we've fought against that in Zimbabwe. Child sexual abuse has become a pandemic the world over, but we also continue to fight that. Although we've got a high literacy rate in Zimbabwe of 93% among our population, but we need to strengthen reproductive health education in our schools. And we have started at grade 4, we now teach reproductive health, including HIV and AIDS. But also, I want to just mention that often in Africa, we are underestimated. People underestimate what Africa can do. And I think this is important to us. In Zimbabwe, we've embraced the three ones, where we have said national governments should lead the fight against HIV and AIDS with one strategy, with one coordinating system, and indeed with one monitoring and evaluation system. And we've worked very well with our own NGOs in the country. In spite of what you hear about Zimbabwe, sometimes very vicious press about Zimbabwe, I tell you that we continue to steadily and very confidently fight HIV and AIDS. That is why we've registered a decline in our prevalence between the ages of 15 and 49. The prevalence was as high as 31% in 1999, it came down to 24.6 in 2003, and as I speak, it is now 20.1%. So in spite of the very bad publicity that we get, we're still the only country that has got a national AIDS levy, where we know that we have not received many resources from outside Zimbabwe, and we have therefore created our own resources by taxing everybody who works at 3%. And that money has helped us to fight HIV and AIDS. We therefore continue to empower people strongly, and we have said we do not politicize in Zimbabwe the issue of HIV and AIDS. And because we are aware that HIV and AIDS is apolitical, we've strengthened the issue of fighting behavior to promote behavioral change, and people have changed their behavior significantly. But we continue, therefore, to thank the Global Fund to fight HIV and AIDS, and malaria and TB. And although we only got the first round in Zimbabwe, we did not get the second round, third round, fourth round. We got the fifth round. We are grateful to that. We hope that we can also get the sixth round. The Clinton Foundation has assisted us greatly. They've come in and looked at the pediatric availability of drugs, and that goes to address also the issue of gender. So 1,000 children have been accessed ARVs through the Clinton Foundation, and of course Zimbabwe is extremely grateful to that. So we must continue to increase the resources that are used to fight HIV and AIDS. And I must add that let us not verticalize HIV and AIDS too much in our developing countries. Let us integrate it to other challenging conditions so that resources are efficiently used. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Minister. I think we are coming along. The next person is Leonard Halmaka. I hope I haven't made up that name. HIV/AIDS Ambassador, Sweden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You did it very well, Leonard Halmaka. Since my Dutch colleague, Paul Beckers, only spoke for 1 minute, I think I can use one of his minutes. I will be very brief, but I have a couple of points. Your Royal Highness, ministers, participants in this roundtable. 8 very, very quick points. Number one, to win this fight, I think we must do that with open eyes and open minds. Not simplify things, not make things easier than they are. It's complex matters, and we must be prepared to realize that. My minister always says that this is nothing we will solve through easy slogans and acronyms. This is something we must realize, that it is about sexuality, it's about gender, it's about violence, it's about trafficking in human beings, it's about drug use, it's about selling sex, and we must be prepared to address all these complex matters. That was number one. Number two, leadership. We need leaders. That has been said by many. I think it's very clear also that those leaders must dare to speak up on the difficult things. We don't always see that. So the link to the first point, leaders that dare to speak up. Number three, the young people. The minister from Burundi, I think, mentioned the young people and the link to prevention. Very critical. Access to information, to knowledge, to services for young people, very, very critical. It's very clear that increased information and knowledge does not lead to increased promiscuity, does not lead to more teenage abortions. It leads to responsible decisions and well-informed decisions. So let's be very clear on that. We train and inform our young people. Number four, rights. Rights to condoms and other affordable commodities, Paul mentioned. Rights not to be subject to stigma and discrimination has been mentioned. And I would underline right to one's own body and sexuality. But we are also very clear on that, a broad perspective on human rights. Number five, not only about women. Peter Piot, in his opening remarks, talked about boys and men. And I think that is critical, that for very many men, both beliefs and behavior of many men must, in a dramatic way, change. So we talk a lot about women here, but let's not forget the boys and men. And I think that's critical. Number six, I also agree with Peter Piot that the outcome of the New York meeting was quite a success. We moved a lot on difficult things, but we didn't go all the way along. The documents that were presented to the meeting was actually much stronger than what we could agree on at the table. So there is some way to go. And I was surprised sitting there together with many of you late in the night that still we had to spend time before we could agree on text on empowerment of women. There were representatives that didn't want to say that women should be empowered. And that was this year, a couple of months back. And we did not manage to include sexual education. We talk about HIV education. So there is some way to go. We should be happy about the meeting, but let's continue the fight. Number seven, this meeting. I think this meeting is a very important signal to the outside world. We are sitting here talking in a very open way about difficult things. It's a very important signal. And it should be a very clear signal, and I hope that your co-chair's text could be, I mean, we're not going to negotiate that one, but that one really reflects that we dare to speak up about the difficult things. Business as usual is not an option, and let's be very clear on that. The introductors to the different subjects in a very good way showed us that we have a long way to go on strategies, on services, on women's rights, on participation, on the empowerment of women. We have a long way to go under all these headings, and we should be prepared to do that. And that leads me to my last and eighth point, the follow-up to the meeting, transform words into deeds. We have heard very many good proposals already on how do we do that? How do we show that we mean reality, that we are serious, that we mean something? I will just pick up three of them. And that was what we heard from UNIFEM. Money matters. I think that is critical. We also heard from Paul Beckers about we need more money for sexual and reproductive health and rights. Sweden very much supports that. But both national budgets and development budgets, it must be very clear, if we are serious, we allocate money. Money is the best, and budget is the best instrument. National legislation is my second point. How do we transform global commitments into national legislation? And my third and last point here is that we need a system for accountability. It has been said by many, I think it's very clear that we need to stay accountable. Decision makers, politicians need to stay accountable. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. After what you just said, I feel I should explain about the summary. This is the summary which some of you have read. It's a summary of us, the co-chairs. It's not a consensus document. However, it needs to be strengthened so that those who want to have input into it will be able to have the chance to do so. Yeah. Thank you very much. So with that, I'll call upon Mrs. Joy Pumapi, Assistant Director General, Family and Community Health, and also a representative on gender equality, Madam Pumapi.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson. I would like to pay my respects to the excellencies and distinguished participants who are present. Very briefly, Madam Chair, we believe that there's a huge gap between the virus and the evidence that is available to combat it. I think we are all in agreement on that. But there's an even greater gap between the evidence that is currently available that can help us to combat it and what is currently being done. And this is where we are particularly concerned. Whilst we shall continue as WHO to pursue the science aggressively with our global partners and believe that more solutions can be found more rapidly than they are currently, we believe that there is a full need to fully apply the existing evidence and that need is extremely urgent. We believe that the best hopes of women and girls is in the adoption of a public health approach which will ensure the protection of individuals and therefore women and girls through addressing directly their rights and needs. We believe that this approach must ensure a continuum of care approach which ensures that you link prevention, treatment, and care so that a mother who gets prevention of mother-to-child transmission must also get treatment for herself and her partner, and she must also get support for caring for the sick, and if it is an elderly grandmother, she must also get support for the orphans that she cares for. We also believe that this continuum must ensure that young girls who are taught about sex education at school, because of the power gains between themselves and the young boys, must also have easy access to youth-friendly health services that can build on this education that they get in out-of-school programs and at school. We believe that this continuum must ensure that healthcare services start in the home, in the household, by addressing the needs that exist in each household, whether they are driven by violence, by the power dynamics, by economic and financial deprivation, by illiteracy or alcohol abuse, and therefore would like to associate ourselves with a call for a woman's body that will ensure that these are addressed. We also would like to advocate for the integration of services in all countries so that reproductive health services such as STI clinics and antenatal care clinics also address the needs of women in HIV/AIDS. And we would also like to advocate for a uniform application of programs so that these programs are not only applied in the public sector but in the private sector and by NGOs that provide public health services. We would like to advocate for the efficient use of the limited resources that are currently available in health and therefore advocating for better management systems and decentralization of services and increased financial resources and infrastructure resources to enable this. To help facilitate this, we have developed a standardized and simplified protocols. We have defined the essential package, and we recommend a clinical team, so a clinical approach to treatment, so that a woman is not told that you are going to get PMTCT in this clinic, you are going to get treatment in clinic X, and you are going to get antenatal care clinic services in clinic Y. And we believe, Madam Chair, that this type of approach should bring us closer to at least making better full utilization of the existing evidence than we currently are. I thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. I particularly like the call for a UN body. Because we want whatever it is that UNICEF did for children, we want that body to do for women. Only then can we progress. So with that, I'll call upon Helge Johnson from the Africa Development Bank, the Mani people.
Thank you, Sheila Tu, Chair, Your Royal Highness, Ministers and friends. We were called by you to talk about what works, what delivers, and concentrate on that. I think we also need to talk about what does not deliver, at least not enough. And I'm now going to talk about the alphabet, the ABC strategy. It has helped many, but it is not enough, and it is far from enough in helping women and girls. Actually, most of us know that the most dangerous woman, the dangerous thing a woman can do is to be married in many parts of Africa, or indeed just to be young is a major risk. That means that ABC is not enough. It is not working for women and girls and not on the continent where I'm and we are working in the African Development Bank. Now, I suggest we have to talk about more letters in the alphabet, and I would add several. I would add D, ABC, and D for development of new tools for women and for girls, tools that can be under their control. We're talking about microbicides, we're talking about new and better female condoms, and we're talking about the vaccine. The vaccine could actually be the most important gender tool that could be provided for girls and women. And I think we know that if the virus was hitting white, rich men with briefcases in the Western Hemisphere, we would have had the vaccine now and all the other tools as well. But because it is hitting mostly, or to a larger degree, poor black African women, indeed, we don't have them, and we don't have the resources to get them. That has to be addressed, and it has to be addressed now. I would also add an E, and that has been said by many around the table, and I don't want to repeat everything they said, but E, among others, for education of girls and women, education as education, but also sex education, and E for equality in socioeconomic fields, in development of their own potential, in legislation and rights. E. Most of you have talked about this, and I won't repeat what you have said, just say, I do agree. We need to add more, because ABC is not enough. So as we fight for universal access of ARVs for all and for all girls and women, we need to get the alphabet right. The overall strategy must be right to be able to protect women and girls from being infected, because that is when the catastrophe starts. We have to prevent them from being infected. And that would be maybe the most important action coming out of this session. If they are, they are entitled to every right to get an equal treatment. But let us try to protect them from getting there. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That ends my part one list. The next group of presenters, I'll start with Mali, Minister of Health, Zainab. Then I have UNICEF, Rima Salah, Zaida Rosenberg, International Partnership for Microbicides. Then I have the Guinea-Bissau Minister of Health, Tessera, Richard Fisham, the Global Fund, where money is, and then end with Sri Lanka Minister of Health, in that order. Okay. May I start with the Minister of Health of Mali, please?
Je vous remercie beaucoup, Madame la Présidente. Je suis le Dr Maïga, ministre de la Santé du Mali, Altesse Royale, Mesdames et Messieurs les ministres. Je voudrais d'abord, au nom de mon pays, féliciter les organisateurs et le gouvernement canadien pour la priorité accordée à cette survine aux femmes et aux enfants, et bien sûr les remercier pour notre invitation à cette importante réunion. Je voudrais simplement partager quelques actions qui, à mon avis, ont fait la différence dans mon pays, qui est le Mali, un pays de au sud du Sahara, et qui a 1,7 de prévalence. Parmi les actions sur l'impact de l'épidémie d'une manière générale, et donc obligatoirement sur l'impact sur les femmes, moi je pense qu'on ne peut pas se taire sur la nécessité d'un engagement politique de plus haut niveau, parce que c'est une action qui a fait la différence dans mon pays. Dans mon pays, le chef de l'État est au-devant de la lutte contre le sida. Et parmi les actions qui ont fait la différence, il y a la décision forte qui a été prise d'assurer la gratuité des antirétroviraux à tous les Maliens qui en ont besoin. Et sur les 9000 femmes, qui sont, les 9000 personnes qui sont sur ARV, 60% sont des femmes. Les 15000 personnes qui bénéficient de soutien nutritionnel et psychologique, 62% sont des femmes. Les orphelins qui ont aussi un soutien éducationnel, 60% sont des filles. Donc, il y a des actions concrètes. Si on fait un appel à l'engagement, on ne peut pas se taire en premier lieu d'abord sur un engagement politique et le plus haut niveau possible. D'autres actions qui ont fait la différence dans mon pays, et personne ne nous a amené à le faire, les femmes ont décidé elles-mêmes. Donc, j'appelle les femmes à s'organiser elles-mêmes, parce que ce n'est pas au cours des forums qu'on va amener les femmes. Nous avons créé nous-mêmes un réseau de femmes parlementaires et ministres, et moi je suis la vice-présidente. Et nous avons amené le gouvernement du Mali à prendre une loi sur la santé de la reproduction. Sous notre pression, l'Assemblée nationale a adopté cette loi. Et sous notre pression, il y a eu des textes réglementaires qui donnent une assistance particulière aux personnes vivant avec le VIH. Pour moi, il faudra une action globale, aussi bien les hommes que les femmes, aussi bien les jeunes, la responsabilité égale, même si l'épidémie a une allure féminine. Donc, il faut une responsabilité partagée, égale et personnelle dans la lutte contre le VIH. Et pour ne pas être très longue, si j'ai des recommandations à faire, je voudrais dire qu'effectivement, il faudra l'argent. Mais il faut l'argent, il faut obligation de compte rendu. Aussi bien pour les femmes que pour les hommes. Obligation de compte rendu pour les jeunes, parce qu'il y a pas mal d'organisations qui travaillent dans le VIH-SIDA, mais je ne suis pas sûre que les résultats sont là. Tant qu'on ne fera pas ce suivi, on ne verra pas les résultats. Obligation de résultat, obligation d'équité, obligation de suivi. Je pense que c'est à ce seul titre qu'on peut avoir des résultats dans la lutte contre le VIH-SIDA. Chez nous, encore, comme je l'ai dit, j'ai dit que l'engagement du chef de l'État a été quelque chose de déterminant. Il préside lui-même le Haut Conseil national de lutte contre le VIH-SIDA. Et chaque année, le Conseil se réunit et chaque organisation a obligation de résultats, obligation de compte rendu, obligation de faits concrets dans la lutte contre le VIH-SIDA. Je pense que cela a amené notre pays à avoir quoique prédominant. On a 1,7, mais c'est quelque chose qui préoccupe les plus hautes autorités de l'État, y compris le chef de l'État lui-même. Donc, encore une fois, tous les leaders, femmes et hommes, aussi bien au niveau des gouvernements qu'au niveau de la communauté internationale. Parce que quelque chose qui a fait la différence chez nous aussi, c'est la multiplication des centres. La multiplication des centres d'écoute, la multiplication des centres de soins. Cela a énormément changé la vie des femmes chez nous. Autre chose, c'est que les organisations de femmes, elles sont si bien tenues que chaque année, il se passe chez nous un défilé des femmes portant et vivant avec le VIH. Et on l'appelle le défilé des femmes, je suis bien dans ma peau. Cela a amené énormément à changer la discrimination contre les femmes. Je vous remercie, madame la présidente.
Excusez-moi, monsieur, voulez-vous...
Vous avez a few minutes.
Comment?
You have just 1 minute left.
Comment?
Vous avez fini. Ah, merci beaucoup.
Je voulais dire que l'action des hommes et des femmes est importante, mais les femmes ont fait quelque chose. Et surtout l'association des femmes vivant avec le VIH qui a révolutionné les choses. Chaque année, le 1er décembre, d'abord, notre action phare, c'est de partager un repas national avec les personnes vivant avec le VIH. Et moi, je suis toujours participante à ce repas collectif. Et la deuxième chose, elles organisent ce qu'on appelle « Je suis bien dans ma peau ». Donc, on fait une élection mixte des personnes vivant avec le VIH. Et elles sont effectivement bien, elles sont comme toutes les femmes, elles sont belles, elles sont jolies comme toutes les femmes, elles se présentent bien, parce que ça diminue la discrimination. Voilà les actions concrètes qui, à mon avis, peuvent amener la différence, mais avec les femmes elles-mêmes. Les femmes elles-mêmes d'abord.
Très bien. Merci beaucoup. Now here from UNICEF Director Rima Asad.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, Her Royal Highness, Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen. My point this afternoon is to emphasize that our leadership today must ensure that children are able to assume leadership in the future. As many of you know, in October last year, UNICEF and many other agencies issued a global call for action to put the missing face of children, both boys and girls, closer to the center of the HIV/AIDS agenda. Since then, we have been campaigning vigorously to increase the scale and impact of 4 interventions that can make a real difference in the lives of children and adolescents. We have dubbed these interventions as the four P's: prevention of mother-to-child transmission, pediatric AIDS treatment, primary prevention among adolescents, and protection, care, and support for children affected by HIV and AIDS. These are not new interventions. They have been tried in different ways over recent years. But now it's time to deliver. That time is now and is urgent. We must act now together to make a real difference to the lives of millions of children, both boys and girls. As we know, children are tomorrow's adults, and it is they who will inherit the burden of reversing the spread of HIV and AIDS. It's so important to empower girls. Tomorrow we have a special session on education and AIDS, girls' education and AIDS. But it is so important to empower girls with education and with information, because they are the leaders of tomorrow's world. They should have the power to make sure that existing AIDS strategies work for women. They need to be able to insist on access to the services to which they are entitled. They will be strong enough to take advantage of legislation that affirms and protects their rights. If we neglect girls' and women's potential to lead, we will not advance towards the Millennium Development Goals quickly enough. Now is the time to deliver, and the women and girls of this world deserve nothing less. So my appeal to you is to empower children to be the future leaders in the future. Thank you very much.
As usual, Rima, I give you 100% for time. The next presentation is from Minister of Health of Ethiopia, Dr. Adhanom.
Madam Chairperson, thank you very much. I didn't actually expect, because I was not in the list of the those countries you selected. So if I am taking anyone's chance, I can maybe take the chance later on, because I was not in the list you read.
Thank you, my brother. I'll give you the chance later on.
Do you still want to give me, or?
No, I'll give you the chance later on. You are coming. Because I want somebody who can go right away. Okay. So I'll have Zita Rosenberg, International Partnership for Microbicides. Women of.
Thank you very much. Your Royal Highness, ministers, and distinguished colleagues. I would like to talk about one specific approach to empowering women in the fight against HIV and AIDS, and that is microbicides. These are products that women can use vaginally to protect themselves against HIV infection. We've heard a number of speakers talk about it today, and I really want to thank Hilda Johnson for bringing it up in her context. And also add that in addition to vaccines and female condoms, we may also see other prevention modalities that we will need to incorporate along with microbicides, and that is perhaps male circumcision, pre-exposure prophylaxis, the diaphragm, herpes suppression. There are many different kinds of prevention approaches, and we are going to need them all if we are going to make a dent in this epidemic and really prevent infection for women. But of course, my organization works on microbicides, and that is what is nearest and dearest to me. With the increasing support from many donor governments and from foundations over the last 5 years, microbicide research and development is moving ahead rapidly. There are many products that are in the last stages of clinical testing, mostly in sub-Saharan Africa, some in India, and the next generation of microbicides that are based on the advances that we've had in therapeutics, the highly active antiretrovirals, are now being formulated as microbicides. And we're investing a lot in novel delivery systems so that the gels may not need to be used only with sex. They can be used once a day. There can be intravaginal rings that can distribute drug for a month at a time or even longer. They're currently on the market for contraception and for hormone replacement, so why can't they be used for HIV prevention? And these are already being tested for safety, and we'll be talking about that here in the conference. I think we need to applaud the pharmaceutical industry for stepping up recently to the plate for microbicides. We've gotten drugs from Johnson & Johnson, Tivotec, from Merck, from Bristol-Myers Squibb, and at a meeting last month, Kofi Annan got a pledge from the pharmaceutical industry to keep on delivering drugs and giving drugs that we can formulate as microbicides. And I call upon this group to keep the pressure up, to encourage the pharmaceutical companies to give us their best drugs, not just for treatment, but also for prevention, because we need them for both. And I think that we need to talk about the risks of drug development. It is very difficult to develop drugs. We need patients. We need support. We need consistency in support. And we need, above all, your advocacy. It takes a lot of work, a lot of drugs in the pipeline, a lot of new approaches, a lot of money, and a lot of political will to get this done. And so this group can play a huge role in advocating for microbicides and keeping the pressure on until we do have an effective one for women. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Zaida. We now hear from the Guinea-Bissau Minister of Health, Honorable Teseria.
Merci, Madame la Présidente. Je voulais simplement faire quelques remarques, surtout dans ce qui concerne mon pays. Les stratégies de prévention de la prévention verticale ciblaient les enfants, mais également les femmes. Celles qui sont dépistées pendant la grossesse doivent faire l'objet d'attention, non seulement pour ne pas transmettre le VIH à leurs enfants, mais aussi doivent pouvoir bénéficier ensuite d'une suivi adaptée et de traitement. En raison du taux d'analphabétisme plus important chez les femmes que chez les hommes au milieu rural, des stratégies de communication adaptées doivent être mises en place pour que cette population des femmes bénéficie d'une information et d'une éducation adaptée dans les domaines de VIH-SIDA. L'intégration des guérisseurs traditionnels, des initiateurs dans le programme de formation sur la prévention du VIH-SIDA est une stratégie très efficace qui représente un lien entre médecine traditionnelle et médecine moderne pour le bien de toute la population. Toutes les autorités traditionnelles présidant aux cérémonies d'initiation des adolescents devraient être formées aux méthodes de prévention du VIH-SIDA. Les nouveaux moyens de prévention comme les préservatifs féminins et des microbicides doivent être mis à disposition des femmes plus rapidement afin de réduire leur vulnérabilité d'infection et augmenter leur maîtrise sur la prévention du risque alors que l'accès et l'utilisation des préservatifs masculins restent limités. Les statistiques d'activité des programmes de lutte contre le sida doivent présenter des données séparées par sexe afin que l'accès des femmes aux services soit connu éventuellement améliorer. La proportion des femmes ayant accès au traitement par ARV doivent être suivies avec attention afin de garantir qu'il n'y aura pas de discrimination. En Guinée-Bissau, cette proportion s'élève 61% sur 102 malades dont l'information est disponible. Quels efforts sont déployés? L'amélioration d'accès aux services au milieu rural est fondamentale. Dans le domaine de la prévention des transmissions verticales et des soins périnataux, des efforts conjoints de partenaires comme le FUNWAP, l'Union européenne, le Fonds mondial et le ministère de la Santé sont effectués dans mon pays. La coordination d'action de tous ces partenaires doit se faire de manière pragmatique à partir des besoins des groupes cibles. La prévention des mutilations génitales bénéficie d'un soutien actif de plusieurs partenaires dans le pays. Lors d'une enquête récente effectuée dans 4 régions de Guinée-Bissau, 24% des femmes déclarent avoir été excisées, bien que 57% des hommes et 50% des femmes aient été opposés. De nombreux efforts sont encore nécessaires dans ce domaine.
Ministre, excusez-moi. Can you wrap up, please? You have just less than a minute left.
L'amélioration des conditions d'accouchement doit être une priorité. Dans les 3 prochaines années, il est prévu d'ouvrir dans 5 régions de mon pays 18 nouveaux centres de dépistage anonyme et 67 sites pour la prévention des transmissions verticales. Cet effort devrait permettre le dépistage de près de 8 400 nouvelles personnes séropositives, dont 5 800 femmes. Est-il prévu de permettre au plus de 700 nouvelles personnes d'avoir accès au traitement antirétroviral? La Guinée-Bissau a entamé la révision de son plan stratégique national de lutte contre le sida, qui est présidé par le premier ministre de mon pays. Qui fait-on pour que les lois garantissent et protègent les droits des femmes? Certaines lois sur les droits des femmes, surtout les lois sur les décisions, ont été déposées au Parlement. Dans quelques mesures, des femmes participent-elles dans le forum et les politiques de lutte contre le sida?
Excusez-moi.
Dans mon pays.
Your time is up.
C'est fini?
Yes. Yeah.
Merci.
Merci beaucoup. Honorable ministers, you'll have to forgive me and everybody else because we still have more than 17 people who want to speak. And we can only do so if we really limit our comments. That's why I was saying, rather than read, because I'm finding that people who read take a longer time, say it from the bottom of your heart, you take a shorter time. So my next presenter is Richard. Richard, I'm calling upon you to be brief, and I know you will be. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Sheila, and good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen.
I haven't introduced you properly.
Oh.
Yeah. Dr. Richard Fitchum from the Global Fund to fight HIV, TB, and malaria. I have to introduce him nicely because he is a guy after a lot of money. Yeah, thank you.
Well, thank you again, Sheila, and good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Since money matters, I've been asking myself during these passionate and committed speeches, how well is the Global Fund doing in regard to delivering for women and girls? And I thought of 4 criteria and 4 questions to examine the Global Fund's performance. The first one is our board gender balanced? The second question is, are our CCMs gender balanced? The third question is, do the programs emphasize gender and the situation of women and girls sufficiently? And the fourth question is, are we learning systematically from our investments in these programs? Let me just briefly attempt an answer to those questions. The first question, is our board gender balanced? There are 20 voting members on our board, of whom 9 are currently women, including the chair of the board, Dr. Carol Jacobs, who's with us this afternoon, and the vice chair of the board, Dr. Leva Franson. And of course, Professor Sheila herself is also a member of our board. So we score 9 out of 20 in terms of gender balance on our board. I suggest that the correct number is somewhere between 11 and 12, given the gender balance of the HIV pandemic. So I give ourselves an okay on that question. The second question is, are our CCMs gender balanced? And the situation there is that we encourage gender balance, we do not require it, and when we pose that question, the answer is we don't know. We don't have data on the gender balance of our CCMs. And that's not good enough. And I give ourselves a poor score on that question. The third question is, do our programs emphasize gender and the situation of women and girls sufficiently? As people here this afternoon will know, we're funding 386 programs in 132 countries already. And again, the answer to that question is we don't know. We don't have at the moment any systematic way of tracking our investment in relation to gender and in relation to the situation for women and girls. And again, I would give a poor score on that criteria.
And fourthly, are we learning systematically from our investments in gender-related issues, especially in the field of prevention? And there the answer is a resounding no. We are not learning systematically from these large investments. So out of the four questions, I gave ourselves one okay, two pause, in fact, three pause, and one okay. And all of that adds up to not enough. The Global Fund can do more in this arena. I think the Global Fund must do more in this arena. And as everybody here knows, the search for my successor is underway. And I'm sure that Carol and Sheila and others on the board will ensure that she is someone who will do more. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Richard. I don't think your next successor has a shoe size to match yours. So she'll not be able to fit in your shoes, definitely. But anyway, we shall make sure he or she does. Okay. The next presentation is by Sri Lanka Minister of Health, Care and Nutrition.
Madam Chair, Your Royal Highness, dear colleagues, while thanking the Canadian government for hosting this important conference and the elaborate arrangements they have made, I would like to share the Sri Lankan experience on the topic which we are discussing today. The Sri Lankan experience, the lowest prevalence in the Southeast Asian region in HIV, is due to the fact that we have invested in education and health. We considered education and health as an investment and not as an expense. Though we had a lot of resistance from the Western IMF models criticizing that there must be user charges, etc. So far back in 1938, even prior to the independence, women in our country enjoy the universal franchise, and we produce the first women prime minister in the world. So that shows the priority we have given to the women in the political arena. And in the area of health and education, we have the equal opportunity, and education is free from kindergarten to that of the PhD level. So therefore, we had the impressive educational background for the women of our country. Therefore, I think the Sri Lankan experience is such that the key factor for the women's empowerment is that of education and health. Therefore, all the respective countries and the political leaders should ensure this perspective for women, not only the smaller, the narrow aspect of HIV only, but we must looking to the broader perspective. Then, of course, we talk so much about the political leadership, high-level political commitment. So, therefore, it is the duty of the politician not only to talk about the HIV, but to ensure that we create a society which would be conducive for the rights, which respect the rights of the women and rights of the girls, and make a holistic approach for motherhood and women. While saying, concluding, Sri Lanka will host 8 ICAP in August 2007 in Colombo, Sri Lanka, and invite all of you to come to Sri Lanka and share our experience with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I'll now go back to my honorable Minister of Health of Ethiopia to take the floor.
Yeah, thank you very much, Madam Chairperson and Royal Highness Excellencies. When I came to this meeting, actually, I didn't expect that it would be another country-by-country presentation. I was hoping that the presenters would follow Madam Chairperson's advice that, you know, we'll dropping the statements, whatever they wrote, and focus on, you know, the issues that were raised by the original presenters. Many important issues were raised, actually, but we haven't actually followed and, you know, discussed at length based on these issues. So I'm actually trying to express, I don't want to hide my feelings, my disappointment, because we could have really revised or developed the proposed, you know, action points starting from action 1 to action 5 if we focused on the original ideas that were proposed by the presenters. Many good ideas were presented, like the accountability issue, you know, how do we address it? The money matters, for instance, how do we address it? Because there was a good suggestion, you know, predictable financing, for instance, even Global Fund needs predictable financing. And whatever we said about the health system, when we talk about HIV/AIDS and reproductive health, do we see it in relation to overall health system, which is gender focused? And you know, whatever we do on gender to make it part of the overall development plan of the country, I think we could have used the time wisely, and we could have focused. But it's like another, probably, sorry to say, but UN Assembly meeting, you know, report after report from countries. So I don't see what we have actually benefited from this. I wanted us to engage into real discussion and come up with some resolutions that can really develop what was proposed, this action, you know, the 5 action points. So I don't know, with the remaining time, if it's possible.
Excuse me, Honorable Minister, we did say that those action points are not, this is not a consensus document. That's why you are on the right track. Pick up something that you want to focus on from the previous speakers. Do that, and actually you are left with 2 minutes to do that.
Yeah, so what I'm saying is we could have benefited if we focused on those and contributed based on that, you know, open discussion and candid discussion. That's what I'm saying. So having said this, I would agree with what Ms. Mary Robinson said. You know, it's related, you know, the checklist issue is actually related to accountability. You know, if we can develop a checklist of what specifically we should address with regard to gender, you know, the social, political, and economic issues, I think that's a very important issue. And the other thing is the health systems. You know, when we say HIV, we shouldn't see it in isolation. We should see it in relation to the overall reproductive health, then in relation to the overall health system and overall development plan of the country. So I think we should really see it in its sensu lato, or bigger sense, rather than go into specific. That's also a very good suggestion. Thank you, Madam Chairperson.
Thank you very much. I'll now hear from the Thailand Deputy Minister of Health, Dr. Shamiviraka, and to be followed by the Vice Minister of Health of Angola, and then Dr. Carol Jacobs from Barbados. Then I'll give up.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Your Royal Highness, Excellencies, distinguished participants. I believe you are aware that Thailand was the host of the 15th International AIDS Conference held in Bangkok 2 years ago. And at that time, we have the theme Access for All. So today, we are under the theme of Time to Deliver for Women and Girls. I have to commend that it is a very good top-up from the last meeting. I will humbly concur to the chairman's request that I should put the note away because I should speak out from the heart. I won't waste your time to say that we have significantly reduced the number of prevalence rates during these past few years, and you may obtain the copy of what I would have said after the meeting if you would like to. I agree with many of my preceding speakers that this time we concentrated much on women and child. And I would like to express my feeling that having worked in this Ministry of Public Health of Thailand and not being a medical doctor of myself, I have experienced seeing the children in the hospitals that I have been throughout the countries, seeing them suffering from not only being an orphan, but also got transmitted from their parents. And I have seen them pass away on and on. And I kept asking to myself how many times I have to go through this grieving moment. And I would like to tell you that Thailand is now concentrating on focusing on children more and women who got transmitted from mother and child transmission. With that in mind, I would like to confirm that we also established a destigmatization program, as the lady from UNIFEM had mentioned before, that not only we will do destigmatize the psychic disorder itself, but also we destigmatize the people who got AIDS infected, and this program is working very efficiently. And in closing, I would like to, since the lady before me had given the alphabetical strategy A, B, C, D, and E, I think she finished at E, education. I would like to add three more, that F, G, and H will be a focus. G is generosity. We cannot do this, solve this problem without being generous. And H is not health, but heart. I think this will be very crucial for us to focus, and I hope by the next meeting we will become more successful in tackling this deadly disease. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I'll now call upon Dr. Carol Jacobs from the National HIV Commission of Barbados, but she's also the chair of the Global Fund to Fight TB, HIV, AIDS, TB, and Malaria. Where is Carol?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I come from a region where the girls between 15 and 24 are predominantly affected in this epidemic. It's also a region which I would remind people is the region with the second highest HIV prevalence in the world. In my own country, in Barbados, the ratio of females in that age group is 3 to 1. And yet, as we talk about education being a solution, in Barbados we have 100% education. Our girls are educated. We have a significant number of women in parliament and in positions of leadership. And therefore, Madam Chair, I'm reflecting that this is probably not just about education. I think, as it was said by Dr. Piot earlier, it is about sexual power relations. It's grounded in social change. And therefore, I just would like us to reflect a little bit and share with you that I think probably one of the key things we need to do is see how do we address this social change. We are advocates. We have been doing advocacy for a long time, but I think we need the next step. And I think one of the critical areas, certainly in my country and in my region, is engaging the faith-based organizations so that we can deal with the stigma and discrimination which causes problems when we're dealing with commercial sex workers, when we're dealing with vulnerable groups. And I think that, therefore, the engagement of the faith-based organizations has to be an important area. It goes without saying, of course, that our NGOs have to be engaged. We need to engage those who define our culture, our artists, our sports people, the people that our young women are listening to. We need to engage our young men. We need to look at, as several speakers before have been saying, how can we enact legislation? How can we have declarations, sign declarations? But I think those kind of issues are critical to the resolution and to the next step forward if we're going to meaningfully do something about delivering for all women and girls. And of course, finally, funding. I would just like to make a plea too that we move to a different level of delivery. But we look at things like behavior change campaigns, we look at emotional intelligence, we look at ways of engaging our population, our youth, our young people who are affected, so that they can lead this fight along with those of us who sit around this table. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Dr. Jacobs. I'll now call upon the Vice Minister of Health of Mozambique, Aida Dibombo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I'd like to thank you very much, the Government of Canada, for having invited us to come to this very important meeting. I wouldn't like to go into details because the other colleagues have talked about the causes for this feminization of HIV/AIDS. But what I would like to say is that in my country, more than 60% of people living with HIV/AIDS are women, and the most identified factor that's contributing for that is the early marriage, women whose partners are engaged in unprotected extramarital affairs, immigration, both for men and also for women, because women also are moving to towns for study or to get jobs. Also, of course, the poverty and unemployment of women. I would like also to tell that in our country, we have integrated activities, all those activities all relate to HIV/AIDS. HIV/AIDS is highly in our agenda, national agenda, is a priority in our five-year program, government program, and also in the PRSP paper for a reduction of poverty in our country. We have decided to strengthen our institutions, especially health and all public institutions, to improve the capacity of human resources, not only by training, but also for in-service training, to improve management capacity to deal with HIV/AIDS, to also improve infrastructure. Also, we defend very much the integration of our services, of our interventions, involving several institutions like health, education, and social affairs, women and social affairs, and all other partners, like private partners and public service. We consider that it's very important to take into consideration the cultural aspects when we are conceptualizing the message that we want to pass to the public, particularly to community level, because we have the challenge of association of cultural aspects to HIV/AIDS because it's related to sexual activity. And they also we have to deal very carefully with the message that we are passing to our people. We want to promote and accelerate education of girls. That's what you're doing in our country. Also to accelerate the literacy of adults, especially the women. And also you're implementing projects to improve the economic condition of women, especially in the area of the agriculture or other activities. We have created youth-friendly services to address the youth and adolescent at school and also at rural areas in the cities where people are living. And also we are strengthening the prevention and treatment of STIs because this area is being neglected because of HIV/AIDS. That's why now you're giving more importance to treatment of STIs. You're promoting the all sexual and reproductive health services in an integrated way. Finally, I would like to inform that from the 20th to 21st September this year, a special session on health of health ministers of African Union on sexual reproductive health will take place in Maputo. And the feminization of HIV/AIDS will be discussed, and Africa is called upon to action and to deliver. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Yeah, we all look forward to going to Maputo. And the next, I think we now have remarks from Michelle Kazakhstan, Ambassador for HIV/AIDS and Transmissible Diseases, followed by